This is the current federal tax developments for the week of July 1st, 2024. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and by your state society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, and from the nice and toasty Phoenix, Arizona, I am going to give you some discussions about this week's key developments in the area of federal taxes. Now, we're going to discuss this week is a few things. First, we're going to begin with a look at the Ninth Circuit that ruled the statute of limitations for the IRS when they look to sue for a improper refund to recover it begins on the date that the taxpayer cashes the check and is presented to the Federal Reserve for payment and the U.S. Treasury approves the payment of the refund, not the date the taxpayer receives the refund check. Next, we're going to talk about an announcement by the National Taxpayer Advocate that the IRS will begin eventually to automate the application of first-time abatement, penalty abatements. But that's going to begin in 2026, so not something you're going to see happening right away. And finally, we're going to discuss a report this week in Tax Notes Today, where they interviewed a number of attorneys and discussed that since the IRS has issued their statement regarding ERC claims, and how they're going to process them, which is effectively very slowly, that they are seeing increased interest both from attorneys in handling suits filed against the federal government directly now to push the matter forward for clients that have a claim for refund and by certain taxpayers looking for it. So we'll talk a little bit about the process, what's there, and a little bit about what some would suggest in the article, some of the attorneys' article, I should say, discussed as the pros and cons of filing suit against the federal government rather than waiting for the IRS to make a determination on your refund claim. Well, let's start with that Ninth Circuit case here. And the Ninth Circuit case here, we have this. This is United States versus Page. It was basically for the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, case 21-17083. The opinion came down on June the 26th, and this is the Ninth Circuit reversing the holding of a district court. The question was, when does the two-year statute of limitations for the IRS to bring suit under IRC 7405 to reclaim an erroneous refund begin? For the taxpayer and the district court, they argued that it begins when the check is received by the taxpayer. However, the IRS ruled, the IRS position was, and the Ninth Circuit agreed, the panel did, that in fact the claim does not start to run until the check is presented for payment and is approved for payment by the United States Treasury, which in this case, it wasn't a short period of time between the two dates, as we'll discover looking at the facts of the case, which are, shall we say, a bit unusual. Nevertheless, unusual facts are why we get cases like this. In this case, here's what happened. The taxpayer was issued a refund of $491,104 instead of the $3,463 the taxpayer should have been paid for his 2016 refund. Now, interestingly enough, the IRS mailed the check on May 5th of 2017. So basically, probably it was a refund related to a return filed right at the end of the filing season, you know, for the 2016 return. So May 5th is in that kind of range you would expect an April 15th filing or whatever the day was that year to get the checks coming out. However, the taxpayer sat on the check until April 5th of 2018, at which point the taxpayer finally cashed the check. Now, probably around then he began noticing that the checks make it very clear they're not valid, they're not to be paid if it is presented for payment more than 1 year after the date on the check. So presumably, and I think it's safe to assume this, the taxpayer got this check. It would not surprise me, though the case doesn't say so, that in fact the taxpayer didn't expect to get $491,104 and so really didn't know what to do with it, but nobody asked for it. You know, it didn't appear like anything was happening. So the taxpayer eventually, before the clock ran out, because you certainly don't want to go back and ask for a new copy of it. You could normally. But in this case, asking for a new copy of a $491,000 check on your return might get somebody to look at the file and might wonder, why is this guy getting this check? Yeah, so he decided to cash the check. Okay, well, eventually the IRS did notice a problem. And the taxpayer did return $210,000 to the IRS, but not the entire balance. Now, we're not told in this case why he didn't return the entire balance, but I wouldn't be surprised to discover that by the time the IRS started chasing after it, he might have spent some of the money, right? So some of the money may no longer be around. He might have lost it on Bitcoin. We don't know what happened, right? But nevertheless, he did return $210,000. So apparently he conceded at least that much was erroneous. And basically, there's really no litigation or no issue where it appears the taxpayer is claiming the rest of it was fine for him to keep. It just, the IRS filed suit against him. Well, as often would happen in a case like this, I don't have the extra money. So bottom line, in essence, the taxpayer not having additional $277,641 to pay just kind of ignored it. So on March 31st of 2020, the IRS filed suit to recover that remaining $277,641. The taxpayer did not file an answer to the government suit. You know, when the government put their complaint in, you're supposed to file an answer, and then that's like litigation commences. The taxpayer apparently just decided to ignore it. You know, if you ignore it, maybe the $277,000 bill goes away. Unfortunately, that wasn't what was going to happen here. The government moved in the district court for default, right? The taxpayer, there had been a complaint filed. The defendant did not respond. Therefore, generally, you do that, you end up getting a default judgment. You know, if you're not participating in the claim, no matter how flaky you may think it is, the plaintiff is going to get a default judgment. So the government went to get just a default and say, hey, you owe us $277,641, and then they could move on to various collection alternatives that they might have. They had filed suit. Now, after the clerk of the court entered the default, right, said, no response, this is a default, the government then moved for a default judgment. A default judgment would say because none of, the plaintiff or the defendant did not answer any of our complaints, you know, we move for the fact that our complaint be deemed, you know, essentially these facts are now admitted, and therefore, hey, he owes us $277,641. This is where a little hitch developed for the government. The district court, the judge, denied the default judgment. At this point, the judge now looked at the case, and the judge decided that the statute of limitations had passed for the IRS to file this complaint. So the judge isn't saying that the complaint is, you know, that the IRS isn't really owed the money initially. It's just that they have waited too long to file the complaint, filing it in 2020. Okay, that was the key. Now, how he did this was pretty simple. He said, you mailed out the refund check in 2017. We're going to say, and we're going to take a look, you know, under the statute, it talks about, we'll see here in a second, that, you know, it must be within 2 years after the refund is made. And he was saying, well, that would be the date that he got the check. And, you know, basically, obviously, you know, he mailed it out in a date in 2017 in May, he should have gotten the check within a few days. So, you know, 2020, I don't care how much time we give you in 2017 to get the check. You know, he's going to have it by December 31st. And, you know, you filed way after. You filed in March of 2020, which means that, you know, he would have had to have, you know, or yeah, he would have had to have been well after that date. So it had been in there as we go, right? It was well after the date. It would be 2 years later, which had been in 2019. So district court said, sorry, IRS, you snooze, you lose, tough luck. Even though the defendant had never raised the question. Now, I will point out the Ninth Circuit panel will also come back on the judge stating that really, you know, he started kind of like becoming an advocate for the defendant who hadn't really been doing anything. And the court kind of said, well, that's improper, you know, in a default situation, you know, you don't step in and say, well, how would I have litigated this case? You know, they think the judge went a little bit overboard on what the judge was doing. It's kind of the impression they end up giving, you know, you really stepped a bit further. Yes, if it was blatantly obvious from the facts as presented that the complaint was too late, fine. But as we'll discover, they're going to say, it's not totally obvious. And secondly, you're using the wrong criteria. So you're wrong as a matter of law is what the criteria was. But they did actually say, even if the criteria had been the other one, you don't have enough information at this point to understand if that if they really were later than 2 years after the date of receipt, because the taxpayer still really didn't cooperate in a couple of other issues that we go on here. Okay, the court found the IRS had filed suit more than 2 years, and the IRS said, wait, there's no evidence whatsoever. There's evidence when we mailed it. There's no evidence when the taxpayer received the check. And so, you know, the IRS said, Judge, if you're going to open up this issue, we at least have to be able to conduct discovery and obtain information from the taxpayer as, you know, evidence of the date the taxpayer received it. So the judge says, okay, you can do that. So the IRS goes and we start getting information from the taxpayer. What date did you receive this check? And the taxpayer's answer was, I don't remember. Not it was sometime in 17. Nothing. I don't remember when I got it. Right? So he comes back with no information whatsoever about when he received the check. Right? So IRS says, okay, back to it. Even if you're right and it's not the date it clears, but it is the date it's received, there is no evidence as to what date it was received. The judge says, wait a minute. Even though the receipt date's not known, common sense, and by the way, the Ninth Circuit put that in quotes, holds that it was more than 2 years after his receipt, right? It seems to be stretching belief to believe that somehow it had not gotten to him prior to 2 years before early March of 2018, which it had to have been delayed at least that long in order for you to, you know, get this suit, you know, basically to be within 2 years of the date filing using the date received as the test, or the date he received the check. And so because of that, you know, the judge decided, which is probably correct, that, you know, he got cash because he watched the clock run out, right? So he was seeing the clock run out. He's got to do action within a year. So basically, you know, the court said, yeah, therefore, we believe it is overwhelmingly likely that it was received before that date. So therefore, we're still going to hold that you're late. The IRS appealed this ruling to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, who, of course, appointed a 3-judge panel to hear the case. So let's think about what this panel did. I mean, the facts are pretty simple and pretty straightforward now. Now, per IRC Section 6532B, recovery of an erroneous refund, this is the statute on the 7405 case. Recovery of an erroneous refund by suit under Section 7405 shall be allowed only if such suit is begun within 2 years after the making of such a refund. So the key question becomes, as the court pointed out, and actually even as the district court was saying, you know, what was the date the refund was made? The statute doesn't say after the date of approving or the date of issuing. It says after the making. So what exactly does making such refund mean under this statute? Right? The panel sought to determine this. Now, they're going to find it is the date it is actually paid, which, because of the nature of the federal claim, the IRS or the government has the right to withdraw that payment, right? If they're making it voluntarily, they have a right to withdraw that payment to basically void the check, or even after presented for payment, they could go ahead and when the final payment comes up, they could disallow, even after it had gone to the Federal Reserve, they could still disallow payment under the law. So according to the panel, it's going to be, no, it's got to clear all those hurdles. That's the day it's actually paid. And what's also going to be key to them is that that's also going to be the first date that the government could file suit to retrieve a refund, because you can't get a refund back until it's been made. And they say, obviously, made in a sense means, you know, it'd be ridiculous to say if he got that check back in March of 2017, and he hadn't cashed it for the government to be able to file suit against him to get the money back, you know, don't ask him for the check, don't cancel it off, just, you know, file suit against him for the refund in June of 2017. They're saying that makes no sense. You'd have to wait for the check to be cashed in order for him to say he's in possession of the funds, therefore now we could do it. So they say the statute gives the government 2 years to file the case, and that's why they're going to argue it's 2 years from that date. But they did provide a number of separate reasons. Let's talk about it first. The first one, as I just said, the government cannot sue until the funds change hands. And the statute should not begin to run until the government can sue. The statute is meant to give 2 years. 2 years for government to act. But if the government can't act because it's, you know, he's not cashed the check yet, then you're going to be able to take that two-year statute down to, in theory, 1 year or close to 1 year by simply setting on the check and reduce the time frame for the government to file the suit. And probably also help because that big check, you know, it may be noticed at some point, but the less time they have to notice it, the less chance they're going to be filing suit. Second, the court said, look, as is clear from this whole discovery we had on when the check was received, it's nobody had, you know, the record of the check being received is going to be inherently difficult to determine in a solid fashion. And the government really is not going to have much idea of when that date is. And remember, they're the ones that are now limited under the statute to file the suit. So it seems wildly unfair in the view of the court to impose a statute the government could not know. If you're going to be using the date of receipt, which is what the district court did, they're saying that, well, that's unfair. The government can't know that date. The only date we can know of our possibles here is going to be either the date it was sent out, which obviously it could be then, but everybody pretty much agreed that that was not the date it was made. So it's either going to be, you know, of the date received or the date that it finally clears the process. The clearing the process date is going to be the one that everybody's going to know what that date is, right? There'll be no question about that date. So they said, secondly, the statute, you know, we're going to assume that it is preferable to have an interpretation that is easier to apply than one that is not, if they're both reasonable interpretations of the statute. Third, they also said statute limitation ambiguities in these matters where the government is essentially waiving the privilege, right? They're waiving, because remember, in essence, you technically can't sue the government, right? The government is immune from suit for most things. It has to allow the suit to go forward. So under the prerogative, right, of the government, because you couldn't sue the king unless the king allowed you to sue them, right? So that's the sovereign immunity theory. So when you're talking about statutes that impact sovereign immunity, the Ninth Circuit found that you have to interpret those in the government's favor because, you know, they are granted at the discretion of the government, right? And because it's their discretion, we have to interpret this in their favor. That's the ruling they have. They also said, fourth, this avoids a split in the circuit courts of appeals. Two circuits have already decided this issue, and both use the date the check cleared as the payment date. That's United States versus Green Thapati. That's probably wrong in pronunciation there. That's a Seventh Circuit case from 2005, and United States versus Commonwealth Energy Systems, which is a First Circuit case. Because those are the only cases that deal with this issue that have gone up to the Circuit Court of Appeals, and both of those came with the same result, it's generally going to be preferable for the Ninth Circuit to follow what the other circuits have done unless they conclude they were clearly wrong. So they said it would avoid a circuit split, so that's a good thing. And finally, they found that the district court improperly attempted to apply a Ninth Circuit case, United States versus Carter, from 1990, which they claim said the payment date must be used. The panel noted that in that case, the only two dates in question, you know, was going to be the issue date or the payment date. You know, basically the date it was received by the taxpayer. And, you know, the court said because nobody, the government nor the taxpayer, was arguing, and the IRS would be fine with timely filing the suit if we used the date the taxpayer admitted they had received it. But we wouldn't be okay if it was the date the refund was granted, I think was the rule there, was authorized. They said since that was the only thing that had to be decided, the court didn't need to decide the actual good date. They could just take, you know, the admitted date and say, well, that's within the range anyway, and it cannot be before that date. And really, it was phrased in that date that it couldn't be before that date, didn't rule what the actual date was. They're saying they misinterpreted, they basically over-applied Carter instead of limiting Carter and realizing it had never really said what the date was. So that's their position. Now, again, it's one of those, it's an odd case, but, you know, it, and as I said, I really do think it was a taxpayer that didn't know if he got the refund, couldn't think about, you know, seems to be kind of acting that theory, like, did I just win the lottery? Decided maybe he did, so he'll cash it. And then eventually the IRS catches up and wants part of it back and just seems like he probably doesn't have it. I mean, if you're just going to stiff him, just, you know, walk off the whole thing. Sending back 210 is kind of a, you begin to think it's very possible that that's all he's got. He's only got 210. So that could explain it. But it is an interesting case from that position as to when they can file the government a claim for erroneous refund. Next up, we have an interesting statement that was made at a conference by the National Taxpayer Advocate. And this was discussed in an article in Tax Notes Today Federal issued on July 1st. I realize that's Monday, right? And in theory, this is the week before, and it's released on Monday, but they always publish the Monday version. It's actually up on the site for subscribers on the Saturday before. So this literally came out on Saturday the 29th. Is when it appeared on their site. So nevertheless, the official date's July 1st, so we'll keep it there. This is an article by Benjamin Valdez, which is IRS to Automate First-Time Abate Program. And as I said, issued July 1st, Tax Notes Today Federal. Now, National Taxpayer Advocate Aaron Collins spoke on June the 28th at a conference sponsored by the New York University School of Professional Studies. And she announced there that the IRS plans to begin automatically abating penalties for taxpayers eligible for first-time abatement. In essence, the computers will start to check, apparently before we even, you know, get a penalty notice sent out, that they will start checking to see if the taxpayer is eligible for first-time abatement under the first-time abatement program. Now, the only piece of bad news is she did say that they don't plan, you know, they plan to implement the change in 2026. So it's like, okay, well, at best 18 months from now, right? And she didn't really say early in 26, so it may be over 2 years from now. But the theory is at least eventually we're going to get an automated first-time abatement program. It makes sense that the IRS should be able to automate this program, right? Because it is a very, very mechanical test. If you're not aware of what it is, we'll discuss it a bit. But the Taxpayer Advocate Service estimates that 1 to 2 million taxpayers every year are eligible for this abatement program, but don't know about it, don't protest their penalties, and therefore are paying penalties that they shouldn't have had to pay because they would have qualified under the FTA first-time abatement program. Now, do realize the first-time abatement program does not apply for everything. I do know some professionals seem to believe that as long as you haven't had a penalty in the last 3 years, any penalty comes up, you can get it waived. That's not how this works. It is a program that's found in the Internal Revenue Manual. And it does describe if you meet certain criteria for certain penalties, then you will get a first time, okay, you know, abatement. For the first time, first problem you have, we're going to go ahead and we're going to abate the penalty. However, you know, then afterward, we're going to go ahead and instead of first-time abatement, then you're going to be able to show presumably things like reasonable cause or some other reason why the penalty should be abated. But first-time abatement applies. And per the IRM, because a lot of CPAs get mixed up on this, CPAs and EAs and attorneys even from time get mixed up on this, FTA is not optional. It doesn't matter, you have reasonable cause. You can't use reasonable cause to get out of the penalty and then, you know, use first-time abatement to preserve your first-time abatement in case they foul up later and they don't have reasonable cause. You cannot hold it in abeyance. If FTA applies, FTA is, per the IRM, to be used by the employee to abate the penalty. So they're not allowed to even go on to whether there was reasonable cause. It's irrelevant. So you can't hold it in reserve and wait till your client does something dumb, right? You know, that can't be justified in order to use it later. Take a look at the IRM. We do have in the slide materials that, you know, you can download the citations. We do have a link to the IRM sections dealing with this. And always, whenever you're dealing with first-time abatement, it's really helpful to go in there and look at the rules And especially, at least until we get the automated system in place, it's helpful if you know them, because sometimes the IRS employees don't know them very well. But if you can run them through the Internal Revenue Manual, which is technically what they're supposed to be following, that's it's issued for them, you know, you can often get the relief if you can walk them through, which why it makes it very useful to understand the FTA program. Okay. The program currently requires taxpayers to seek abatement. And as we say, we've had issues with IRS employees just being confused, not understanding the program, maybe not even really knowing what it is because they forgot that part of the deal. You know, we just whatever, it doesn't always work. I think we've all had that situations where you've had to maybe even try to escalate a relief issue because this should be FTA, right? But the employee you get on the phone is brand new, just doesn't really understand their training, and some reason thinks you don't get FTA. So basically, this should simplify the matters. It should take, that means the IRS should be receiving fewer phone calls because automatic FTA will take those 1 to 2 million penalty notices essentially out of the system. And that includes, remember, you got 1 to 2 million that don't know it applies. You've got a whole bunch of others who maybe have, you know, tax professionals that know it applies, but they still got to get on the phone to get the requests and get the requests in, and the IRS has to handle those. So in theory, it should work best for everybody if this gets automated. But as I said, 2026, so it's not going to happen next week. Okay, we'll do it that way. Now, the one thing, the big thing to remember about FTA is it is limited in which penalties it applies to. As I said, it will not apply to everything. And there is an IRS page on the IRS website for information on the first-time abatement program page. And I have the link for that as well in the citations this week. And it's really helpful to go there. Again, the IRM is the technical side. You want to follow that. But for just kind of like the executive overview, the 40,000-foot view of how the program works and something a client might understand, you have to translate a couple of things for them. But otherwise, that they might understand, That's the easier page to work from, certainly for your initial look. So the following penalties can be abated. Failure to file is the big one, right? A failure to file penalty, if you meet the criteria, that includes failure to file an income tax return under 6651A1, failure to file the partnership returns under 6698A1, and failure to file an S-corporation return under 6699A1. So general tax returns that have balances due and those two flow-through returns are all covered by this rule. So if you qualify, you can get out of that first and potentially even subsequent, as long as you spread them out more than 3 years apart, failure to files, okay? Keep that in mind. Also, failure to pay penalties. Under 6651A2 and A3, right? That's when you're late paying the tax in question. Or failure to make deposits properly under 6656. So those are the penalties. If you have a penalty under anything else, it doesn't qualify for FTA, right? You're going to have to go and argue to see if the penalty can have reasonable cause exceptions. You have to make arguments under those rules. By the way, there is a whole nother section of the IRM that deals with reasonable cause exceptions and what they're told to accept and not accept. That's very useful to look at as well, right? And it's on the IRS website. The IRM is there. So yeah, it's kind of useful to go through that and make sure you can put yourself in so you can walk the employee through exactly how in the IRM you can justify your reasonable cause, right? Look, go here, follow those steps. We meet those criteria, therefore you check that off, you can make the waiver, you know, and you've saved them work, which can be very helpful, right? They might go along with your view of how to read it. Now, there are some additional criteria you must meet. You can't just do this first time. What it is, the way you have this relief is you must not have had penalties, essentially, within the prior 3 years, right? Okay. So you must not have had any assessable penalties within the prior 3 years that were not waived due to essentially anything except for reasonable cause. You know, if you had a reasonable cause waiver or other waiver, that doesn't count against you. Now, in theory, you probably, you know, so that means you could have first time abatement, and then that could be followed by a waiver for, you know, first time abatement. Then maybe somewhere there in the next, let's say 2 years later, there is a failure to file, but it qualifies for the relief under the rules for, let's say, reasonable cause. You come back again. If, as long as you now got 3 years that are clean, there is no penalty because the one got waived for reasonable cause, you could still get first time abatement on the fourth one that is flaky. Now, the reason you could get reasonable cause in the interim is because you weren't eligible for FTA for that year. So keep that in mind. It also cannot be a way, you know, you can't get around it under mechanisms where it appears that your primary goal was abating, or let's say, getting out of or avoiding, shall I say, having to worry about the first time, or basically that you weren't trying to avoid payments in that way. So essentially, when we look at this, the failure to pay penalty, and I see what's happened here. I've noted that apparently I didn't get the slide up I thought I was going to get. It's probably sitting back there somewhere else in my slide deck, knowing the way it is. But what I'm going to tell you is, so basically your rules for first-time abatement is, as long as you have filed the same return type, if required, for the past 3 years before the year you received the penalty. And notice that says if required. So it can work for a first return, right? It can work for a first return. And you didn't receive any penalties during the prior 3 years or any penalties that was removed for an acceptable reason other than first time abate, right? So you either didn't receive any penalties in the prior 3 years or any penalty was removed for an acceptable reason other than first time abate, right? If you don't have any, if you, let's say, you request FTA for your 2022 return, you don't have any unresolved penalties on 2019, 2020, 21, and didn't get FTA relief in those years, you have a history of good compliance. If you have the history of good compliance, the additional requirement is that you also, you can grant that if a total of four or more failure deposit penalty waiver codes are not present in the prior 4 years. So if it turns out you keep waiving failure deposit, you know, for even if for good cause, even if for reasonable basis, you're not going to get FTA, right? The catch is, it's like, nope, we're not going to allow it then. You have to keep proving reasonable cause. And a fair deposit penalty was not charged for electronic payment, federal payment tax system avoidance, right? You were trying to avoid doing it. That also is going to be part of it. As well, you don't get it, right? There are additional criteria. It does not apply if you have a return with an event-based filing requirement, right? So if that has to be filed after a certain event takes place, that's not going to qualify for this. If it has a daily delinquency penalty, right? You know, like, let's say, a not-for-profit return, it only has a daily delinquency penalty if you're late on it. So that won't qualify for it. Or if the information reporting that is dependent on another filing, if that's what the penalty is going, that of course will also not qualify you for first time abatement. So those are the ones that will tell you simply don't qualify. Okay. Now, I did say the additional information, it is IRM, I always hate IRM references, 20.11.33.2.1. If you go there to that IRM manual section, which was updated on March the 29th of last year, 2023, that will be the current manual. Now, if they change it, that date behind it will change. That tells you it's been updated. Every IRM section will tell you basically when it was last updated. So in this case, March of 2023 is when they updated the first time, last updated the first time abatement section of the Internal Revenue Manual. Finally, we've got a article in Tax Notes Today by Lauren Lauricchio. It says, taxpayers weighing refund suits for ERC claims. This came on Tax Notes Today Federal, again in the July 1st edition. Now, as you're aware, we talked about recently, the IRS put an announcement, in fact, it was last week we talked about this, on the fact of how they're handling ERC claims processing. And it wasn't good news for people that have claims in process. essentially, they decided that 70%, about 70% of the claims that were received before the moratorium are going to need more processing, more information before they can make a decision. Of the others, about half of the other group that is not in this group, half of them appear to have little questions, few questions, and they did say they started sending those out sometime this summer. And then the other group, but they didn't really say how quickly, and they didn't say they'd all get out this summer. So, you know, that's not much. We've got a start date. We don't know if your client's going to be in the start group. And then the other group, which had seemed to have an earlier start date, were the ones that the other half of the not the 70 are ones that are just absolutely the service police. Just by looking at what's on the claim, they can show right away it doesn't qualify. Those will be getting disallowance claims soon. But of course, for those 70% of claims that were issued before the moratorium date, that were sent in before the moratorium date in September of 2023, we're just saying we're still working on whether there'll be what answer there'll be. So that's not really good news if you're looking for the payment. And they also noted they're not announcing any plans at this time to begin processing claims filed with moratorium date because they say they're going to work the claims before the moratorium date first. So if your client filed a claim, let's say in late September of 2023 or early this year because they were trying to beat the statute of limitations on the 2020 claims, we have no idea when they're starting. So, you know, that's frustrating. Clients don't like that answer. You know, well, the IRS says they're not going to get you for quite a while, and I don't know when you're getting your money. And clients always want to know, well, can't you do something, right? Well, yes, but, and we basically talked about this before, we'll go through a little more here, because this is what you can do. So this has led, per the attorneys interviewed by Lauren for the article, an increased level of interest, both among attorneys who are going to offer the service to file suit against the IRS to force the refund claim to be adjudicated in court without the IRS deciding up or down on the claim, and also clients who are now expressing interest in going that route, because it appears that otherwise things are going to stick out there for a long time. Now, that said, there are some issues here, and some issues going to make this not a very practical answer for a lot of clients. But let's talk about the option, because it is what the law gives you. Under IRC 6532A1, it provides that no suit or proceeding under Section 7422A for the recovery of any Internal Revenue Service tax, penalty, or other sum shall be begun, this is by the taxpayer, remember, the Ninth Circuit case was the IRS coming after it, before the expiration of 6 months from the date of filing claim required under such section, unless the secretary renders a decision thereon within that time frame. What that roughly means is that if you filed a claim for refund with the court on January 1st, when we get to July 1st, right, basically now, IRS has not ruled on our claim. We can immediately go to the district court or the court of claims and file a suit for refund against the United States. Right? We can, in essence, instead of allowing the IRS to sit on the claim and wait for it, we can force the issue by going to court. Right? If the IRS actually does make a decision and mails, you know, the disallowance of any part of your claim, then you have 2 years from that date that the IRS mailed the notice to you in order to file your suit in either of those courts for your refund. But we're talking about right now, the IRS is sitting on it. What was pointed out and discussed in earlier articles has been, there's not really any way in the code to force the service to decide on your refund. Your way to force the issue is to go the suit method and bypass the service, right? Their administrative process is just bypassed if you file suit against them. Okay, so is this something your clients should be doing? Should all your clients who did ERC be signing up with these attorneys and filing suit in federal court? Not so fast. There are some issues here, right? Now, we do know, though, that a large portion of the ERC claims still to be processed have been filed more than 6 months ago. Remember, there was a big drop-off in claims filed once the moratorium was announced. So the IRS is sitting on a significant number of claims today. Probably, I wouldn't be surprised that 90-plus percent of those claims are more than 6 months old right now. And, you know, obviously, by the time we get to April 15th, I would expect a large portion of them. Because remember, April 15th was the last date to file a claim for 2020. So basically, assuming Congress doesn't change the date. And so that's why I also think it's going to be earlier, because a lot of us knew that there was a proposed law, which did pass the House overwhelmingly and still hasn't passed the Senate, that would have moved that date and may still move that date to January 31st. Like I said, I'm expecting by the end of July, I would not be shocked to find that 90-some percent of the claims are this. Although, yes, the service did, because the service did say they got a lot right at the end of the, or they got a lot of claims to withdraw right at the end. But these claims here, yeah, I'm sure some people may have set on them until April 15th. But my guess is that because of the threat of January 31st, it was dangerous unless you were only applying for 21. To have waited to go after that January date. And even with 21, it was dangerous because that would have ended the claims for 21 as well. So I'm betting 90 plus percent of the unprocessed claims will meet the 6 month criteria. In that case, then let's say that your client likely has the right to file suit. Now, why you might do it? So one of the reasons why you might need or want to move forward? Well, you may have a severe financial need. I mean, we need this money to come in now or we're going under. So even if you're going to take a big discount by the legal fees you're going to pay in order to file this claim, you know, in order to get this money through the courts, if you don't get an award of attorney's fees, it's still like, yeah, we need the money. We'll go ahead and take that discount because we have a large enough claim and, you know, we can't afford to wait. You might also just decide you have better use for the funds. I'm sure most people believe they do. You know, they have better use for the funds than the IRS does, than the government does. So, you know, you might decide, I just want to go forward on that basis. You know, I want to use the funds. I may want to use them to expand my business, whatever we're doing. Or, and I think this is a very real one, let's say that you're either looking to complete, you're looking to complete an acquisition, merger of some sort. Having this hanging over one of the parties can really complicate or give the other party cold feet about going forward, right? Because there's been so much talk about the fraud and other issues. There just may be a concern about going forward. I don't want to buy a company, you know, where there's this question about things they did and maybe, maybe they went over the top. Their claim wasn't valid. Could there be some consequences? Well, especially if I'm going to get the stock, or the LLC interest, I got to be very worried about any consequences there. So maybe I want to complete that, right? Get the acquisition done or, you know, and just say, look, there's no problem. We have now been awarded this by the court. So, you know, don't worry about it. It was a totally valid claim. That's no longer a risk factor in our acquisition or your acquisition of our company, right? We've got rid of that. So those are valid reasons we might want to move it forward and speed it up. And don't want to just sit there and wait on the IRS whenever they get around to it. Because again, we have no idea when it's going to be in, well, essentially all of these cases except disallowances. Remember, the IRS didn't tell us when they published that description, oh, here's the list of clients that are flaky. And here's a list of clients that look like they have little risk. And here's the list of we don't know. They didn't publish a list at that time. So you don't know which category your client's in. Probably best if your client appears to have a rock solid case. I'd always say that's true. If your client is pushing the edges, it might not be one to accelerate because you'd prefer somebody else went to court first, right? So there would be litigation on the issue and you hope the IRS loses. And at that point, then you can ride the coattails somebody else who spent the money to litigate this. Because especially if there's a big question about it, so it's a messy question of law under the ERC and what applies, the case could easily be very messy to try because a lot of details and a lot of arguments have to be made at the district court level. And then the IRS may very well, if they lose, appeal, or you may need to appeal if you think you're right. And, you know, we start bouncing these around, and it could even be you'll be picked for the Supreme Court, right? If they just want to get this taken care of. And this is definitely, given the money involved, a big enough program that I could see the Supreme Court picking it up. Okay. Now, the article also notes that assuming your clients want to do this, their attorneys already beginning to advertise that they will take on such cases. They will do ERC litigation under claims for refunds. So they're already out there, right? But they did note in the article, other attorneys noted, there are risks in filing these. A big one, not mentioning the article, but it's just the one your client better be aware of, is you're going to be paying some rather significant retainers that are not coming back to you, right, in order to litigate. It's going to be costly to litigate the case. And no matter how good your case is, it's always possible you won't prevail. Right? And if you don't prevail, generally attorneys taking this on who aren't associated with the promoter are going to tell you that, no, we're going to litigate this, going to try to defend it. The catch is they may tell you, look, this is a theory. It might work. We think we can argue for it, but, you know, now nobody's tested this yet, so you might not win. So there could be a lot of money spent on litigation that may turn out to be losing litigation. So that's more money down the hole, right? It may put the taxpayer in the crosshairs, was the term one attorney used in the article. By that meaning, you'll be subjected to special scrutiny, and you may be subjected to other things. So they'll be looking for this. So you'd like the client to be squeaky clean, not only on the ERC claim, but everywhere else. And, you know, you may find a lot of issues. For instance, it may or may not be considered relevant by the court as to whether your client timely filed an amended return asking, you know, paying in the extra tax due for the disallowance that would occur if you've got this. I always thought there is some risk that would be seen as a quasi-admission that you don't know if this claim is good, right? You don't have confidence in the claim because you didn't go ahead and pay the tax. You kind of did it and really not sure what they're going to do if the statute's closed and you can no longer amend the return to pay the tax. That usually doesn't impress courts, though. So, you know, you waited out the statute. Again, I don't know I want to go to court on that one. That wouldn't be good facts. Maybe they'll tell you you're fine, but it's just that's going to have a bad smell to it. And I would much prefer to have the IRS lose the law issue for the ERC claim standing alone on its own, and then see if we have any issue coming up with the other stuff, rather than get that front and center. It may also prove risky to the professional. If your client is going to file one of these suits, you better be very careful here's the problem. You as an accountant with accounting background and a tax law background, you understand a lot of the things that are used in the test for the ERC, like the test for gross revenue, right? That test for gross revenue is all from tax code and regulation provisions that deal with how we test gross revenue. So we know if we can meet the test in essence for $25 million adjusted for inflation for revenue, so we could use the cash basis. You know, that uses the same revenue definitions that are used here. So the problem is, it'll be easy to argue you should have known. You know, your client got talked to somebody. They were told, yeah, go ahead and file the suit. The attorney says, yeah, we're going to do it. But you know that because you have the ledger, that there is no way they met the revenue test, right? The revenue test per what you've got and per their filing method, you know that they're not going to qualify or they're not going to meet the requirements laid out in the IRS notices. Now, that doesn't mean the notices are right. But a lot of that was coming with cross-references from Congress, which means those you can't ignore. And secondly, it is probably useful to know that if you're going to be fighting against a notice in court, or if you're just going to be fighting against, you know, there is no authority here, the IRS didn't deal with your situation, that's a very different litigating position. So you want to be sure the client is clean. You want to be sure they're also clean otherwise. Because again, You do not want to bring them up before the court and up before the IRS and then the crosshairs if there is other problems that aren't maybe directly related to the ERC, but the IRS becomes aware of during discovery for the ERC because, yeah, things can go badly at that point. So you need to be very, very careful of how that goes. I think for most clients, the costs are simply not going to be worth it. Now, the bad news is all a client can really do in that case, if you don't want to file suit, you could sit back and hope that there's a couple of cases trying to force the IRS to process faster. Like I've said before, I really think the mere existence of this option is going to cause the courts to say, nope, you've already got your relief. It's in the statute. Use it. Go to court. And I think that's going to be especially an interesting fact for, you know, when a judge is sitting there saying, well, wait, I'm a district court judge. You could have just filed the claim right here with me. Right at this point, you got out more than 6 months. Why are you asking for them to do it when you could have just had me do it? And that'll also be a question I expect will be asked more, not so much by the most recent one filed by a promoter, but I could see it asked by taxpayers because, you know, the first case we had on this was a medical practice that was filing, and they were filing weirdly, like not really asking the IRS to, not really asking the court to adjudicate that they qualified, but rather asking the IRS to ignore the notice they had and to process the claim faster. And I always thought, it just seems, I think the court's going to wonder, why are we being asked to adjudicate this? Because, you know, they obviously, they're here, they're spending the money, you know, why do they want to present this to the IRS? And the only reason you're going to come up with is because the IRS is overwhelmed, right? And so they figure that nobody will look at it if they get forced. But yeah, and the judge may not like that theory. I think for the promoter, it's probably easier for the court to realize that they have no direct standing. But that then gets to the question of, do they have any standing at all to do this sort of thing? So if I had to bet, I'd say, I'm not going to say those cases have no chance of succeeding, but I would say I would lean against their chances of winning. I hope to be wrong, but I'm just saying if I had to bet, I'd think that, right? You know, you look at that, and for a lot of clients, like it or not, the smartest thing to do, unless they have some really compelling reason to need the money right away, not want it, but need it, you know, and probably it'll be the case, well, you know, might as well sue. If we lose and we're turned down, we're going out of business anyway. So who cares, right? You know, unless we get it fast, we're not going to be around. So why do we care if we lose? You know, well, I wouldn't tell them to care about that in terms of some liabilities that might escape and might go after their individual assets, depending upon the structure of the business and other issues. But yeah, in that case, maybe it's worthwhile. Well, this has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of July 1st, 2024. Current Federal Tax Developments, as always, is brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and by your State Society of CPAs. You know, I will be back next week and we'll start, you know, thinking about whatever happens in this very, very short week. This week could be interesting. In fact, up to be totally honest, I'm not sure there'll be enough happening to do much of anything except sign on and say, yeah, nothing happened this week. Because there may not be much going on. I say that, and then suddenly, you know, sometimes IRS likes to drop a big something they think is going to be controversial late on the afternoon just for a holiday. So either nothing happens or something huge comes out on July 3rd, right? Late in the afternoon. Now, I realize the 5th is not technically a holiday, but they know as well as somebody else does that, you know, in essence, a lot of people are going to be gone from the 4th through the, you know, all the 4th through all the way to the end of the weekend. So I'm sure to the service, it's become clear that if they really wanted to drop something controversial, they could stick it on late in the 3rd and basically it'll be ignored. And by the time people get back, it'll be kind of old. And, you know, and so they're catching up from the weekend and stuff. So that might be a good time to try it. And possible. We'll have to see what happens. But anyway, this has been the Current Federal Tax Developments. Remember, if you have questions, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. I'll try to check there. I also follow the Connect sites for Arizona, Idaho, New Jersey, Minnesota. So be sure to check on there. And again, otherwise, we're going to be back here next week with more information on additional current federal tax developments.